All right, ladies and gentlemen, we'll now continue our program. If you're not at your seat, please return to your seat. We'll now go on to the program. There's lots more interesting, many more interesting aspects of this issue to discuss, and we want to get right into it. As I said, we have a distinguished panel now after lunch, and there will be some opportunity for questions afterwards. Relatively few amendments have been proposed to the state constitution in the 38 years since the last constitutional convention in this state, and that's for good reason. Some extra effort is required to amend the state's basic law. Before a proposal can be submitted for voter approval at a statewide referendum, two consecutively elected legislatures have to approve it in identical form as a resolution. And that's what happened in this case. And in fact, the amendment on the ballot this year, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say, is one of the most significant, if not the most significant, to be presented to New Yorkers since the Blaine Amendment battle of 1967. As we've noted, and I'd like to point out in a little more detail, this amendment would allow for an automatic contingency budget in the event a fiscal year begins without action on a governor's budget proposal and would eliminate any requirement for the legislature to act on the governor's proposals. I'll take a minute now just to explain the most important aspect of the budget process that needs to be understood to follow what's going to be said now, and what is really at the heart of the amendment. There's many other technical details that could be discussed and that you'll even hear raised in remarks of campaigns by advocates of this proposal, but what's really important about it is what I'm going to discuss now. And that involves the core budgeting powers of the governor. Under the state constitution, the governor assembles and is required to assemble a balanced plan of revenues and expenditures and submit it to the legislature in the form of budget bills, appropriation bills. And those bills must be introduced in the form he sends them to the legislature automatically in the legislature, by the legislature in both houses, the Senate and the Assembly. And that's automatic and is unique in terms of the way it's treated. Now, the legislature, however, as was noted earlier, is the sole body in government with the power to spend money, to appropriate money. Money is spent by elected legislators, not by executives. The authority to spend money or direct the spending of money rests with the legislature. However, under the Constitution, the legislature of the state of New York is not allowed to appropriate any money for any purpose until it has finally acted upon the governor's budget bills. There is no other requirement facing the legislature. The legislature is not required to pass a budget on time. The legislature is not required to pass a balanced budget. In fact, the legislature is not required to do anything except if the legislature wants to spend, which is naturally the legislature's favorite thing. It cannot do so unless it first finally acts upon the governor's budget bills. And that action can take three forms, basically. It can strike or reduce items of appropriation in the governor's budget bills. And if it strikes, that is, eliminates or reduces an appropriation proposed by the governor, that action is unilateral and there's nothing the governor can do about it if he hasn't agreed to it already. If both houses pass a budget with some items reduced or eliminated, that's it, that's final. Another thing the legislature can do is it can add separately stated items of appropriation to the governor's budget, in which case the governor has the ability to veto them, the so-called line item veto, which the legislature can then override if two-thirds majorities can be mustered in both houses. That's the current system. That's the core of the current system. Here's the change. Under the proposed amendment, the budget process every year would begin, just as it does now, with some difference in dates and a few more details. The governor would present the executive budget in the form he now presents it. It's rich in detail. It's thousands of pages. It weighs several pounds. And the legislature would then have to consider them in that budget in the form of appropriation bills, as it does now. However, if the state reached the end of the fiscal year, of the old fiscal year, without the legislature having finally acted upon the governor's budget, the governor's executive budget would simply expire. That is, it would vanish. It would no longer be a live issue. And the legislature, in fact, would be prohibited from acting upon it. In its place, the existing budget, if you will, would remain in effect as a so-called contingency budget. automatically. Furthermore, the amendment explicitly states that this would automatically amount to final action for constitutional purposes. This will mean, in effect, that the legislature has acted by doing nothing, in effect. And then at that point, the legislature will have the ability to enact a multiple item appropriation bill amending the contingency budget. What this effectively does is it allows the legislature to use the current budget as the basis for a new budget of its own design. The governor would still possess a line item veto over changes that are made in that contingency budget. It is worth noting that the governor also possessed a line item veto even under the system that Al Smith and all the other reformers changed in the 1920s, because under that system where a budget is created by or given birth to by the legislature, a line item veto was not sufficient to control and organize expenditures after a while. So I just wanted to create that framework. Those are details that are pretty much beyond dispute in terms of what the core change is here. And now I'd like to introduce our panel to discuss different aspects of this and its implications. Our first presenter, Dahl Forsyth, is a distinguished lecturer in Baruch College's School of Public Affairs. His previous academic posts included 3 years on the faculty of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's also taught political science and finance at Columbia University, and he's been a senior fellow at the State University's Rockefeller Institute. Mr. Forsyth has extensive management experience in the private and not-for-profit sectors, respectively, as a managing director in Lehman Brothers' public finance department, and most recently as chief administrative officer of the Episcopal Diocese of New York. Most notably, for our purposes here today, he was the director of this division of the budget under Governor Mario Cuomo from 1988 to 1991. Our second speaker, Diana Fortuna, is president of the Citizens Budget Commission, a nonpartisan, nonprofit civic organization devoted to influencing constructive change in the finances and services of New York State and New York City governments. A well-known public finance analyst, Ms. Fortuna began her career at New York City's Office of Management and Budget, where she rose to become deputy budget director during the tenure of our third guest, who I'll shortly introduce, Mayor Koch, in fact. She then served in New York State's Washington, D.C. office, where she analyzed federal policy issues. Most recently, before joining the Citizens Budget Commission, she was associate director of the White House Domestic Policy Council and was a key policy aide to the administrator of the U.S. Healthcare Finance Administration. Ms. Fortuna graduated from Harvard University and received her MBA from Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. Last but not least, we have one of those people who truly needs no introduction, the 105th mayor of New York, Edward I. Koch. I won't rehash in detail the landmarks in his eventful career, but we'll note that, like Governor Carey, Mayor Koch is closely identified with New York's recovery from the crisis of the 1970s, and also, like Governor Carey, he's been involved in budget making from both the executive and legislative perspectives, having served in Congress for 9 years before his election as mayor, and before that having served 2 years in the New York City Council.